Please be seated. We do. Actually, you can keep standing. Behold, I make all things new. How does God work in the world? How does God make things new? It really is one of those important and most difficult theological questions. And it's been back in the news after the attempted assassination of former President Trump. Not so much here, but in the United States, the debate is actually a hot topic. I get some journals that come from the States on my feed, so I've been reading questions about this. Opinionators are opining, preachers are preaching, and people want to know exactly how God was able to save former President Trump's life. Did God send a wind gust to move the bullet a fraction of an inch to the left? Was there a guardian angel who somehow protected Donald Trump? Did God cause the shooter to blink as he was shooting? Now, sounds kind of silly maybe to some of us who have grown up in Anglican circles. We don't generally ask those sorts of questions, and so are generally spared the awkward follow-ups, such as, if God sent a wind gust to move the bullet just a smidge to the left, why not a bit further so that the innocent firefighter didn't die? Why not make the gun jam so that no bullets were fired at all? And this one, if God is able to save one potential victim from gun violence, did God not hear the prayers of the parents of little Johnny and Sally as they watched them meander down the sidewalk to school and then learned hours later that their lives were cruelly snuffed out by a shooter? Okay, so God as master puppeteer theology doesn't make much sense to many of us. But does that mean that God winds up the world like a clock and then simply allows it to tick away, having no involvement in it whatsoever? The deist move in reaction to God in control of everything. For people who take the stories we consider week by week with any kind of seriousness as revelation of God's passion for the world, God's concern for justice, God's closeness with people and creation, God can never just be a mere bystander simply watching, as if we're just a matter of entertainment for the divine company that particular evening. So how does God make all things new? How does God work in the world? Well, before you imagine that I'm flying just a little bit too close to the sun with such a question, I'm sure through great signs, like the one that Jesus performed when he fed the 5,000, it's one of those things that all scholars seem to be agreed on, whether liberal or conservative or in the middle somewhere, that Jesus was known as a great wonder worker. And I'm not going to be one to doubt that. And of course, in many other ways, far too mysterious, numerous, beyond my simple comprehension. But our scriptures today seem to demonstrate one way, maybe the main way even, that can make a huge difference in our lives. Nathan the prophet, more about that word in a moment, comes to David after David has murdered Uriah the Hittite by the sword of the Ammonites to cover up his adultery with the now pregnant Bathsheba. It's a mess. This is the same Nathan who earlier in 2 Samuel was really David's sycophant, David's yes man, telling him that if he feels like building a temple to the Lord, he should go ahead and do it, for obviously God is with him. But Nathan is about to learn what it means to be a prophet and not just a yes man. For the Lord showed him very clearly that David should not build the temple. Now, Nathan has to go back to David and renege on his earlier affirmation, but that correction was relatively easy, I think. That was probably just a matter of putting the brakes on David's hoped for legacy project. But what Nathan is about to do now, he earns his chops as a prophet here. He's going to do something far more difficult, indeed something that very well might have cost him his life. Because, as we know, kings in the ancient Near East were gods. If you were an advisor to a king, you were expected to agree with the king's wishes. Advisors didn't advise. Advisors agreed with the king's desires and sought to implement them. That Israel imagines first a society without kings, first part of her history, and then when she pines for kings and gets them, seeks to constrain them with laws, with expectations of ruling righteously, was something very new in the ancient Near East. That she basically failed at this shouldn't surprise us. That she imagined it is at the root of what we now take to be obvious, the pursuit of an equitable society. Now, of course, even most Christian monarchs, though crucially not all, and certainly all autocrats, whether they profess faith or are simply acting out of a secular ideology, have not thought they are constrained by laws at all. Denise and I have read our fair share of historical fiction from the mid-16th century, and we're always struck by the fact that all the political pushing and pulling, all the betrayals, the torture, the executions happen because nobody knows how to navigate Henry VIII's constantly shifting desires and moods. It really is just about what's inside one man's cranium. And certainly, Wolsey, Moore, Cromwell, and Cranmer, they never act as Nathan acts here. And indeed, we have good evidence that the priests were told in the chapel that Henry attended, that they were to avoid reading any texts like we have today. Nobody upbraided him for his murderous behavior, his greed, or his roguish fits of rage. Nobody ever spoke a revelatory parable in his presence, and certainly nobody ever said, You're the man. Nobody. And as a result, England suffered. England launched into horribly expensive and draining wars. And Henry himself suffered torments of anxiety and doubt, for it is a great horror to be left to your own devices and to have all of the power to enact your will. But you're just a finite creature, so you don't know. Am I doing the right thing, really? So here it is. Probably, and again, I put some caveats in here, probably the main way that God works in the world is through the patient development of character in each of us. Remember, Nathan needs to learn to be a prophet and not a sycophant. That we might come to the point where we're able to speak the truth to each other in love. This is why the word prophet is one of those incredibly important words in the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Testament itself. It's a word and a designation that has very little to do with predicting the future and everything to do with illuminating our hearts in the present. Which is why Paul, when he's telling the truth to the first followers of Jesus in Corinth, says this: pursue love and strive for the spiritual gifts, especially that you might prophesy. Strive to illumine the truth in your relationships, whether in your marriage, in your partnerships, in your advising of co-workers, in your deliberations as leaders in society, whether in a church or in a town council, and in your friendships. I find an easy way to remember what prophecy is that it's simply speaking in a way that profits others. Speaking in a way that profits others. And when we are brought to truth, to a place of willingness to change our minds, to a new realization of what's possible for us, and whether then we're the messenger or the recipient, right in that thing there, we're partnering with God's intention. We're partnering with God making the world new. And this often happens through stories. The story that Nathan tells David is probably the purest form of a parable found in the Hebrew Scriptures. And I suspect, though I could be very wrong in this, that it very well may be the story that inspired Jesus to use parables, to speak in a way that bypasses our defenses and reaches into the heart. Because Jesus is all about the heart, and this story demonstrates, like no other, the ability of a parable to do that work. In fact, it's one of those instances where Nathan's speaking of the truth has now influenced, if I'm right, the greatest teacher of all. Yelling at someone doesn't change them, doesn't change the heart. Neither does arguing passionately with someone. It feels good, but it doesn't actually accomplish that for which it is set out to do. In other words, those things reinforce our defense mechanisms. They bring up the guard of fear and anxiety. But it's only when we hear something by which we come to self-realization that we change. Which is why, of course, therapists are always doing this thing, right? Where they're listening to us, and then they say, just when we're waiting for some advice or some, you know, telltale teaching that will unlock the box for us, they'll say, oh, tell me more. Drives you crazy when you're in that setting. But this is what happens with David, right? David comes to self-realization. He's not even convinced by this dramatic, you are the man. That kind of comes as the coup de grace at the end. What he's really changed by is empathizing with the poor man in Nathan's story. Jesus takes this one step further in our gospel reading. His great miracle of feeding the multitude has not changed the people's hearts. So when he then tells them the truth about their motivations, he's not simply saying, you are the people who always act selfishly. Rather, he accepts their desire for food security. I mean, that's just basic to human desire, something that you and I take for granted. But he uses that desire to invite them into a deeper desire for the bread that makes life, life, eternal life. And says, here it is, right in front of you. It's me. His truth-telling doesn't stop at what's wrong or not complete, but moves into, and here is what's possible for you. I was deeply moved this week by a person who told me that they were going on a retreat with 20 other people to examine, quote, the role of internalized shame. The role internalized shame has played in my life and how it has fed the harsh inner critic inside my head. I was deeply moved because it's 20 men and they're going on this secular retreat, quote unquote, but its aim is the gospel. Its aim is love and truth. The aim is for this group of men to be prophets to each other through the risk of it, the danger of it, the beauty and the sheer rapturous joy of truth-telling. How does God move a bullet to the left, as it were? By people like Nathan telling the truth about guns and violence, by people making the case for a different kind of society and doing it in such a way that people's hearts are moved from fear into trust. This is what Jesus says. This is the work of God, that you believe in me. And the word believe all throughout John's gospel is trust. That you trust me. That you trust my way. Would that all leaders had Nathan. Would that all people had someone close to them willing to tell the truth in love. Wait, that's us, right? That's why we're a church. That's the beauty of church. To uncover the truth in all of its stop us in our tracks, starkness, and even more so in all its jaw-dropping beauty. Spirit of gentleness, spirit of restlessness, stir me from my placidness. Amen.